Välkommen till Hästveterinärerna, en podcast från Boehringer Ingelheim Animal Health. I den här podden samtalar vi med specialister från olika områden inom hästmedicinen. Med det gemensamt att de delar vår och din passion för hästarna.
Välkommen till Hästveterinärerna, podden för dig som är veterinär eller djursjukskötare och arbetar med hästar. Jag som pratar heter som vanligt Maria Willemsson. Magsår, det är ett mycket vanligt problem hos hästar, i synnerhet de som tränas och tävlas. I de kommande avsnitten har vi därför bjudit in Michael Hewitson. Han är diplomat i internmedicin och arbetar som forskare och kliniker på Royal Veterinary College i London. Vi spelade in de här samtalen i samband med att vi också spelade in två webinars med Michael. Ett om ESGD och ett om EGGD. Dessa webinars kan du som är veterinär se när du loggar in på vår hemsida vetportal.se. Men om du redan nu vill höra Michael berätta för oss om magsår hos häst, hur de behandlas och förebyggs, så är det bara att lyssna vidare. Hewitson, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So, why don't you start by telling us about yourself and your background?
Well, I've been an equine veterinarian now for over 20 years. I actually grew up in South Africa. You might be able to pick that up from my accent. And came over to the UK after I'd graduated from the University of Pretoria, where the vet school is in South Africa. And I worked in private practice here in the UK for a while, and then actually did my residency, so my specialist qualification at the University of Glasgow in Scotland. And it was during that time that I started to develop an interest in what in those days was just known as equine gastric ulcer syndrome. Subsequent to qualifying as a specialist in internal medicine, I went on to do my PhD. And it was then that I decided to actually investigate an alternative diagnostic test for EGUS, or equine gastric ulcer syndrome. And I spent some time in Texas A&M in the States, actually, where there was a colleague of mine, Professor Noah Cohen, whose group had done an initial study looking at, sucrose, and we can talk about that in more detail later, as a potential diagnostic test for ulcers. And that's how I sort of got involved with that. And then since then, after I'd completed that work, I worked in the Middle East for a while in a very busy sports horse practice over there. So got quite a lot of experience dealing specifically with competition horses, and it was a very useful time, for me, because it was good to work in that industry, and it helped me understand the challenges that veterinarians and racehorse trainers and, owners of competition horses face when it comes to things like gastric ulcers, and also made it a lot easier for me to understand the limitations regarding the sort of advice I can give these people, because it's, it's very easy, I think, for vets to just, give a whole list of management changes that they suggest to treat gastric ulcers. But actually, I think sometimes you forget that these people earn a living out of, competing these horses, and sometimes there are limitations to what they can do and still achieve the results that they want to achieve. So that was very useful for me. And then actually I moved to Finland. So actually I have a little bit of a background in the Nordic countries. I worked in Finland for 5 years, actually, at the University of Helsinki. I really enjoyed my time there. I loved working in the Nordic countries. And it was there really that I started to develop a specific interest in equine gastric ulcers, and We, in 2015, myself and some of my colleagues were asked to write a consensus statement for equine gastric ulcer syndrome through the European College of Equine Internal Medicine. It was from there that the research into specific aspects of equine gastric ulcer syndrome in general, but specifically equine glandular gastric disease, became much more focused. And we could talk about that later. But ever since then, I've had a particular interest in researching and developing our knowledge on equine gastric ulcer syndrome in horses. And then, it's a long story, and then I went back to South Africa and worked in South Africa for about 3 or 4 years at the University of Pretoria again. And then finally ended up here at the Royal Veterinary College in London, where I am currently. I'm an associate professor here in the Equine Internal Medicine Department, and have got a quite active research group specifically focused on equine gastric ulcer syndrome.
Mm-hmm. So that's a very... diverse background. You've been all yeah. over the world and working with all these horse owners and horse owner populations and horse populations. But what would you say are the biggest differences between these different countries that you've been practicing in?
Well, that's a good question. I think if you compare working in the UK and probably also in the Middle East to the Nordic countries, of course, the big thing was, you know, in the UK and in the Middle East, we were working with thoroughbred race horses. Whereas, of course, in the Nordic countries, it's all about standardbred racing. So that was quite interesting for me. Of course, you know, as you will see in my webinars, you know, there's not a huge amount of difference between the standardbred and the thoroughbred with respect to the prevalence of gastric ulcers. But it was a really interesting learning curve for me, because of course the management and the way the horses are trained is quite different. So that was one big difference for me. And then I think the other, completely other side of the coin, of course, working in South Africa, we did quite a lot of work in rural areas with horses and donkeys that were working equids. And I think a lot of people forget about that aspect of the equine industry. And if we think about all these risk factors for equine gastric ulcer syndrome in our performance horses, well, you can imagine the risk factors for working horses that are undergoing the same potential challenges, like, for example, not having free choice access to roughage and not having water always available, you know. And I think it was really interesting, because in these populations of horses, they, of course, had very high prevalences of gastric ulcers as well. And the challenge there came in with regards to, well, what do you do about it? Because a lot of these people couldn't afford long treatments with acid suppressants, omeprazole, and that kind of thing. So a lot of what we did was management changes. And it was very surprising just how effective management changes by themselves were in managing these horses and donkeys with gastric ulcer syndrome. So it was a useful learning curve for me, because it reiterated the importance of not just pharmaceutical treatment, but the importance of combining that with, you know, appropriate management changes and just how effective that could be.
Mm. Yeah, I imagine. And also this group of horses, I guess, isn't really prioritized also in research. And yeah, you tend to sort of forget about them.
Yeah.
So that's very interesting. And we're going to talk a little bit more about management in a while. But also, since you've been working for quite some time and you've been studying this interesting disease all the way since it was only one condition that we knew of, and then we know so much more today with these two different conditions. What, except for that obvious fact, what has changed since you started working with the EGUS patients?
When I first started, working in the equine field, as you say, you know, in those days, we talked about gastric ulcers, and that was that. And in the very early days, and I'm, you know, I think we have to really, I have a huge amount of respect for the early researchers who really were they were groundbreaking insofar as actually starting to gastroscope horses and identifying that they had these lesions. But in the old days, you know, the gastroscopes were very different to what they are now. They they weren't video endoscopes. So the length of the scopes certainly there weren't 3 meter scopes in those days. So there was a lot of limitations to what they could see in the stomach. And I think naturally, and because of those limitations, most of the work was focused on reporting what they could see, which was the squamous mucosa. And so if you look at a lot of the research in the early days, it was about squamous gastric disease, and there was very little information on glandular gastric disease. As I say, primarily, I suspect, because they just couldn't get down to the pylorus in those days. Mm. And then, in 1999, just when I sort of came onto the veterinary scene, there was an effort to start to sort of consolidate the knowledge that these early researchers, Mike Murray and people like that, Frank Andrews, and they put together this equine gastric ulcer syndrome panel, and made an attempt to sort of at least put a name to what they had seen, and so we started to talk about the concept of equine gastric ulcer syndrome rather than just gastric ulcers. But it was only really until the early sort of 2014, 2015, that we really started to realize actually there was more to this than just squamous ulcers. And that's when we put the consensus statement together, which was really the first time where we started to look at this disease as two separate disease entities. So, I mean, from that perspective, that was a huge change, and that generated a huge amount of research, which has really helped us understand the disease much better now. But then I think the other big change was our understanding of the pharmaceutical management of this disease. You know, the early literature, as you well know, was all associated or related to Gastrogard, which was, of course, the first product that was registered. But there was a lot of information that was still missing, specifically regarding the pharmacokinetics and the actual pharmacodynamics, i.e., you know, how this drug actually affected acid at the level of the stomach. And so, you know, between 2015, after the consensus statement came out until to date, you know, there were a large number of papers that came out that helped us understand how omeprazole actually works in the horse. And I think that's made a huge difference to our ability to treat this disease. And, you know, all the recommendations which we take for granted now, things like, you know, medicating horses on an empty stomach and medicating them prior to feeding and that kind of thing, we wouldn't be where we are now without those studies. So I think, you know, pharmaceutical research, as well as a better understanding of the fact that this is two separate diseases, are probably the two main changes that I've seen over the years. And I think going forward, I think the future now really is going to be about developing a better understanding regarding the pathogenesis of glandular gastric disease. I think that's the big unanswered question we still have, which I'm hoping, you know, the younger generation coming through the veterinary profession now will take a renewed interest in that, and hopefully we can learn more about this disease, because I think it is very challenging for both veterinarians and owners, as you well know.
Mm. Yeah, it's definitely a very interesting sort of puzzle to solve or question to answer. How about the horse owner community? What are the biggest differences compared to, like, when you started working with this? How much awareness there was, and how compliant they would be to to treating or compared to now?
Well, I mean, you know, I use the term the old days, not really the old days, but, you know, if we think 20 years ago, most horse owners would not have been aware that their horses even develop gastric ulcers. I think it was far more, there was far more awareness in the racehorse industry, because of course this perception, that it affects performance. But, if you think about your average horse owner, that perhaps has a horse that they use for pleasure riding or dressage or show jumping even, I don't think there was really a clear understanding at all that this disease even existed. And I think that probably is partly related to the fact that most veterinarians, you know, in the early days of this, of EGUS, were really, not ill-informed, but they just, that the information wasn't out there. You know, if you look in textbooks back in 20 years ago, you know, gastric ulcers in horses was maybe a small little paragraph at the end of the chapter, you know. And because gastroscopes weren't available in those days, they were the remit of referral hospitals and that was it. Gastric ulcers just simply weren't diagnosed. So I think since then, you know, with a more of an awareness amongst veterinarians of this disease, it's become much, much more commonplace, in the, you know, in the psyche of horse owners. And as you well know, nowadays there's huge amounts of information on social media and in the, on the internet, available to horse owners about gastric ulcers in horses. So I think there's been a huge shift, almost a paradigm shift in the understanding of the fact that horses can actually get ulcers and what we can do to prevent them, amongst owners over the years.
I wanted to stay a little bit with a horse owner, because you mentioned in your webinar some very interesting research that you have just recently been doing in your research group, that considering then how good the horse owners are at recognizing signs of EGUS, because as you say, I mean, the awareness is very high. There's this information of this disease all over, or these diseases all over the internet. And it's often something that you would hear horse owners say, well, have you checked for EGUS or have you checked for ulcers, in more or less any situation where their horse is not behaving as it should, according to them. So tell us a bit more about this research that you've been doing and the results from this.
Yeah, well, this research actually stemmed from a frustration that I had, insofar as I've never really felt comfortable that I've understood what the characteristic and classical clinical signs of gastric ulcers is. And let's not use the term glandular gastric disease or squamous gastric disease, but just generally gastric ulcers for the time being. You know, there's just so many clinical signs reported for this disease. But my experience as a veterinarian was that many situations, I would see horses with quite severe gastric ulcers that showed no clinical signs, or I would have owners that were you know, absolutely convinced that their horses had gastric ulcers, and then we would scope them and they would have a completely normal stomach. And so I thought it would be very, very valuable to try and find out if there was some kind of statistical association between clinical signs that we report as being possibly related to gastric ulcers and what we actually see with the gastroscope. Initially, I wasn't specifically interested in owner's perception of it. It was just that that was the only information I could get, because of course, as vets, we don't watch these horses every day. So we have to rely on owners to give us that information. And so what I decided to do, was to send out a questionnaire to owners prior to them having their horses gastroscoped, with essentially outlining with some questions any clinical signs that they may have recognized in their horse. And then the important thing about the study was that this was done prior to them knowing the results of what we found on gastroscopy, so they, you know, so that there wasn't any bias from that perspective. Mm. And then we would gastroscope the horse, and the idea was that we would then compare what we found in gastroscopy to actually what the owners had reported. And as you can see in my webinar, specifically for glandular gastric disease, now I've also done this work for squamous gastric disease. I haven't published it yet, but I suspect that's going to be a similar finding. What we found was, very interestingly, that owners' perception of what they consider a clinical sign for their horse, you know, potentially having an ulcer, let's say, for example, flank sensitivity or colic, there was no association between that and what we saw on gastroscopy. So essentially some horses had no clinical signs, but they had ulcers, and others had what, according to the owners, lots of clinical signs that they considered classical for gastric ulcers. And when we scoped them, they had completely normal stomachs. And I think what's going on there is a thing called confirmation bias, or observer expectancy effect. And that's a very well-known source of bias in clinical studies, where you're relying on people to give you information about the clinical signs of a patient. So these owners, because as we've said already, have all this access to all this information on the internet about gastric ulcers, and you know, your horse has got gastric ulcers if it's got flank sensitivity, or your horse has got gastric ulcers if it's crib biting, for example. And so owners, of course, see their horse doing that and are convinced that their horses must have ulcers because they're showing those signs, not considering perhaps that there might be another reason for why the horse is doing that. So they almost convince themselves that their horse has got a clinical sign because they convince their horse has got gastric ulcers, if that makes sense. Mm. And so I think a lot of what we were seeing in the results was associated with confirmation bias. And I think it's important to clarify, I'm not saying for a second that there aren't clinical signs associated with gastric ulcers. It's just, I think we haven't got good enough at recognizing what they are yet. Mm. And I think the take-home message for me from this study was two things, really. The first is, currently as it stands, I don't think we can only rely on clinical signs reported by owners to decide whether we should be gastroscoping horses. I think we should also base it on recognized risk factors. So if you've got a racehorse in intense training that's perhaps not performing as well as it would normally be, and it's got all the risk factors for gastric ulcers, then that's the sort of horse that you should probably gastroscope. But I don't think we can just rely on clinical signs for that. And then I think the other side of the coin is I think we should be somehow trying to work out what clinical signs are in fact associated with this disease. And that might be that we need to do some studies where we put cameras into stables and get veterinarians or people that don't have an inherent interest in that particular horse to look at that horse from an objective perspective and see if we can start to document perhaps other clinical signs that we've missed up until now that will help us improve our ability to recognize horses that would benefit from gastroscopy.
Mm. So, but I was going to come to that. So as a vet then, which, I mean, you talk about the risk factors, but which actual clinical signs should I be reacting to, or how should the decision on whether to scope or not be made?
Yeah, it's a good question, Maria. And it's quite funny. When I submitted this research for publication. I actually presented it at a congress recently. One of the reviewers' comment was, "This is very disappointing results." And I think that's exactly the point, because, you know, the big question is, well, what now? You know, what do we do? Because, I mean, I looked at over 400 horses, and I can tell you for a fact that there is no association between the clinical signs that we're seeing for glandular gastric disease, certainly. So I think the important thing is, at this stage, we shouldn't ignore these recognized clinical signs. And of course, we need to take them into account. And I think particularly things like flank sensitivity, which seem to be very, very specific for glandular gastric disease. But in addition to that, I do think that we might be missing horses that perhaps are not showing clinical signs, but have the classical risk factors. Or on the other side of the coin, maybe, you know, a horse that's showing these, recognized clinical signs, but in fact has none of the recognized risk factors. Maybe we should be saying to owners, well, look, you know, let's see how the horse gets on for a while, and perhaps look at other things rather than jumping straight into gastroscoping those horses. So I wish I could give you a more clear answer. I think the take-home message I would like to get across is that we still don't understand the significance of the clinical signs that are reported for gastric ulcers in horses. And I'm not saying we should ignore them, but I do think we should be considering the fact that there might be horses out there that have gastric ulcers that don't show clinical signs.
Yeah. And then I have to ask you a follow-up question. Is it your perception that there are horses that get these ulcers, and maybe specifically then the glandular ulcers, that gets them as a secondary to something else, you know, that they are suffering from something that you don't recognize at first hand, and then you recognize these ulcers, you treat them, and they come back?
Yeah, a predisposing factor, yeah.
A predisposing factor, exactly. How good are we at looking for those and considering those?
You know, if we go back to glandular gastric disease specifically. And I think, you know, when we're talking about gastric ulcers in horses, I do think it's really important that we should always clarify what we're talking about first, because as you would have seen from my lectures, it's absolutely critical that we clarify which part of the stomach we're talking about, because of the differences in things like risk factors and treatment. But if we think about glandular gastric disease, we still don't really understand the pathogenesis, but what we do know is that it's almost certainly related somehow to behavioral stress. And, you know, there could be a myriad of different things that could be causing a horse to become stressed, and as a result, it develops glandular lesions. The classic example I have is we recently had a horse, in fact, it was belonged to one of the nurses in our hospital, that developed very severe glandular gastric disease. And despite months and months of treatment, this horse just never really responded to treatment. So it was a classical non-responder, as we call it. And after talking to my colleague in detail about her horse and the management that this horse was receiving, it turned out that this horse normally was turned out with several other horses. But recently there had been a public footway had been opened next to the paddock that this horse and the other horses were in. And so the other horses that this horse had been in the same paddock with became really, really stressed every time people walked past. So they took them out of the paddock and left this horse by itself in that paddock. And, you know, it's such a simple thing, but, you know, we forget that horses are gregarious animals. They herd animals. And you won't believe it, but by changing that one aspect of that horse's management and providing it companions again that weren't separated by a fence, within 1 month, that horse's gastric glandular disease had resolved. And it made me absolutely convinced that a lot of what we're seeing is secondary to stresses that we don't necessarily recognize. And that, and one of the first things I speak to people about when I'm treating this disease is I say, you know, what's changed in your horse's management?
Mm.
You know, can you think of anything that has changed? And often I say, I ask them a direct question. I say, do you think your horse is happy?
Mm.
I mean, it sounds silly and it sounds anthropomorphic, but it's very, very true. You know, and simple things like, you know, giving them companionship and making sure that they can look out over a stable and there's another horse on the opposite side. You know, those little things can make a huge difference. And I think that's certainly a predisposing factor. Then the other commonly asked question I get is lameness and musculoskeletal conditions a predisposing fact? Because, you know, logically you'd think, well, horses that are in pain are in stress. They have an increased amount of stress and presumably that might have implications in the development of glandular gastric disease. Now, there is no work out there that's looked at that specifically. Mm. And I think it would be a really interesting thing to look at. The problem is that it's quite, there's a lot of confounders.
Yeah.
You know, you can imagine it's very difficult to tease out what the risk factor is and what the predisposing factor is, because of course, you know, musculoskeletal disease, those horses might be on high doses of non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. They might be, management might have been changed because they were lame. So it's very hard to work out which aspect of that is actually causing an increased likelihood that the horses have developed glandular gastric disease. But to answer your question, there's no doubt in my mind that there are many underlying predisposing factors to this disease. And I think the big overriding theme here is behavioral stress.
Yeah.
And I think we need to be looking at our horses more carefully and understanding their nature and understanding the fact that they're herd animals and understanding the fact that things that we might not necessarily consider stressful for them is extremely stressful for them.
Mm.
You know, and as I say, I always think back to that example and I use it every single time I speak to vets about non-responding horses. And I say, you know, this was a classic example. And we threw, you know, thousands and thousands of euros worth of money at this horse and nothing worked. And we changed one aspect in its management and within a month, those lesions have resolved. So, so you know, I do think it's really important to consider that.
That's that's very eye-opening,
I think. Yeah, it is.
And also requires some detective work from the vet, but that's, on the other hand, a big part of all veterinarians' work, to be good detectives.
Tack för att du lyssnar på Hästveterinärerna. Om du gillar det du hör, glöm inte att trycka prenumerera i din podcast-app så att du inte missar några avsnitt. Berätta också gärna om vad du tycker genom att ge en recension. Vi tar gärna emot tips på kommande gäster och ämnen, och våra kontaktuppgifter finns i poddens beskrivning.